professional opportunity for my spouse led us to spend 2 years there. My professional background in public radio for about 15 years. The most recent chapter, education and experience, taking me into the field of intentional intergenerational interaction and community building, with a particular emphasis on nature-based settings. I've worked in nursing homes, recently part of a intentional intergenerational child care and adult care day program. And my interest in accessibility and being outdoors and intergenerational experience led me to working with Wilderness Inquiry starting about 4 years ago. I came on as trail staff full-time in May, the 1st of May of this year. And I do have long river experience on the Mississippi in Ontario, the Blood Vein from Ontario to Lake Winnipeg in Manitoba, and on the Yukon. So the Mississippi will be my fourth major river.
My name is Andrew Gustin. I'm from Indiana originally. Moved up to St. Paul about 4 years ago for some work. I have a background in geology, a master's degree from Indiana University, and I've worked on a couple of geothermal energy projects through Indiana and or the Indiana Geological Survey, and also through the University of Minnesota. I started my own cartography business about 3 years ago, making digital maps and apps, and then just in May I signed on with Wilderness Inquiry because I love being outdoors and camping, and so this trip seemed like a natural fit for all of that, and couldn't pass up the opportunity to join along going down the river.
Sitting in the right spot.
That was
easy. Thank you. Well, we'll go get some gear organized for the river.
Yeah. So thanks so much. Yeah, and we'll touch base at lunch and
yes.
Head out and do some hiking and canoeing and stuff. So thanks. Yeah. So I think maybe John, you were gonna start with a land acknowledgement statement,
yes.
And then Bert would go, and then I'll speak a little bit, and then. Engage in hands-on
think about the Anthropocene, right, within the context of this area as well. And, right, and when you think about the Anthropocene, there's many ways of formulating conceptually what the Anthropocene is, but the two ones that came to the forefront of our field station's activities and thinking about how we would define the Anthropocene is not just human-caused climate transformation, geological transformation, but also the another way of thinking about the start of the Anthropocene is also to recognize its relationship to the colonial history of the United States as well. And so the series of events that we've organized for the last 3 days was an attempt to try to do a little bit of both, right? And so by reaching out to a variety of Line 3 oil pipeline activists, but specifically within the indigenous communities that try to link the relationship between human-created and caused climate change and the ongoing legacy of oil pipeline creation within this region, but embedded within a critical history of the United States that acknowledges the colonial past, was our attempt to sort of create a land acknowledgement statement that went beyond just a kind of formal speech that could precede the entirety of the launch of the Mississippi and Anthropocene River project. You know, there's other things that were going on in the background, of course, but those are the two main concerns that we had trying to organize the events of the last few days. And so I'm going to read to you now the formal prepared land acknowledgement statement that we wrote collectively. It wasn't entirely written by every member within the field station. It was primarily written by Rupali Thadke, who is an environmental scientist that does, and Shanai mentioned her work with Rupali yesterday, but Rupali does a lot of work around mining and water quality, dam removal issues in this region. It was prepared by Rupali Thadke, Anya Kathleen-Seen, who is a graduate student at the University of Minnesota in geography with a focus on sediment in the Mississippi River, and I was involved as well in writing this land acknowledgement statement. This project, so this land acknowledgement statement is the preface, or is the preface to a booklet that we're publishing in conjunction with the events that are happening on September 20th and 21st. And the booklet is an analytical, critical treatment of the projects that you'll see if you can join us in the Twin Cities on those 2 days. So this project has been created by a collective of people, each of us differently positioned toward the places in which and about which we work. We share the context of working and living on traditional, ancestral, and contemporary homelands of Dakota, Ho-Chunk, Anishinaabe, Ojibwe, Menominee, Powhatan, Ottawa, among many other Native nations. You hear that?
through all this, but I hope there are enough turns that they provide material for questions. Okay, many of the people around here know the house, but there are also quite a number of people who do not know the house. So I hope to say a few things which even the people who know the house may not know. And we will see. The house we are in is was a present of the United States in 1957 to the city of Berlin. We are in the Cold War situation. The war ended, and Germany, of course, morally, ethically, was really a non-agent, a completely spiritually destroyed country. That was the situation you have to imagine in the 1950s. In that context, there were in Berlin, of course, as you know, two powers working. On the one side, the Eastern Power, and Moscow and the Soviet Union built in the eastern part of Germany a big, a huge alley, which was called the Karl Marx Alley. And the idea behind this alley was to show how workers can live as bourgeois people, to provide them bourgeois conditions to live in. And this was at the beginning of the 50s. And the counter project to that was a big architectural fair on the other side, in 57, on the western side, where major Western architects were building what they understood under modernity. So there was a whole housing system was installed. And part of this project was the Congress Hall. The Congress Hall we are in right now. And the Congress Hall was meant as a kind of educational building for the Germans to learn what democracy is. And was a present of the United States at that time to Western Germany. When you go through the text of the people, and one of the major drivers behind the project was Eleonora Dulles. And you know, I don't have to tell you who the Dulles family is.
You might.
It was John Foster Dulles.
Oh.
You might have to tell.
Okay, so Eleonora Dulles was part of the Dulles family. And one brother of the Dulles family was foreign minister. The other one was head of security, of
CIA.
CIA, mm-hmm. Of the CIA. So they were the major agents, so to say, in the Cold War situation. They were involved in Iran, they were involved all over the world, you can say. But they did this nice present to Berlin to educate what the Germans about democracy. And in the statements of, for example, Eleonora Dulles, you can really read that this was meant as a kind of symbol of democracy for the German people. And the architecture tries to translate this into open spaces, very urban environments, spaces where you like to meet. And if you imagine West Berlin or Berlin in the 50s, this was a deserted island. It was under ruins. And then you got such a place. I mean, it was a real jewel in the desert. We have images of these places, really incredible. So it became also really a magnet. People were just fascinated by the architecture of this building. Interesting enough, I'm telling a lot about, but perhaps it is not so uninteresting. In this very same year, the embassy in Baghdad by the United States was built. And the embassy in Baghdad at that time had the more or less same architecture. The language was the same, a language of modernity. I mean, it was, of course, also a way to attract the world to the American idea of freedom and democracy. But the embassy in Baghdad has to be closed after 7 years because of security problems. so the building, this building in Berlin, was to some extent the symbol for the relationships between Germany and the United States. And this a highly politically charged project. So, for example, John F. Kennedy, before he died, in his last speech he gave in Germany, was in this building. So you can imagine what kind of symbolic value was put in the Cold War situation into this building. So, what is interesting, in 1980, the building collapsed. It is imploded. And just to give a nice anecdote, there is a major German techno-industrial music group which is called Einstürzende Neubau. Einstürzende Neubau means collapsing buildings.
Yeah.
And I asked the leader of the group a few years ago, did you name your group after the HKW or after the Congress Hall? And he said, no. We first founded the group and then the building collapsed. So this was, so to say, the prehistory to the HKW. And so there was an agreement that one had to rebuild the building because of German American friendship. And then the question was what to do with the building. And then the idea came up to have an institution for the non-Western world. And the idea, put it straightforward, is a kind of politically cultural development idea. So there is the West who has a lot of art and culture, but the non-West, they have no means to present themselves, so to say, in the center of Germany or in the center of Europe. So we give them a quite, let's say, luxury space to do that. And of course you can imagine what the criticism was at the beginning. I mean, and to some extent, of course, it was a quite new neocolonialism. The Germans went through the world collecting what they thought is important and bring it to Berlin. So there was good intentions, but bad executions. And so there were a lot of discussions around how to transform, so to say, the conceptual approach. And then, let's say, end of the 90s, the House took over a post-colonial approach. And this basically meant to involve non-Europeans as curators to the House, and the two projects in the House. For example, Ocre Invesa did a major project there, and okay, and Paul Gilroy and others did projects there. The problem at that time was that Germany, I mean also the intellectuals part in Germany, did not understand Germany as a colonial country. Which, I mean, saying that in this context is perhaps a bit ridiculous, but it was really the case. And the reason for that was that the intellectual power and energy in Germany up to that point went to reflect what happens in Nazi time, what happens in fascism. And so there was a very detailed and very complex analysis of the fascist past of Germany. But what did not happen was to relate that to colonial issues. Because, of course, today one would look at this as an inner colonization which was going on, which was mentally directly related to the outward colonization of European countries to the outside. But that this kind of critical discourse was not there in Germany at that time. So to some extent, also this project had good intentions, but it failed really to reach the major intellectual discourses in Germany. So when we started in 2006, 2007, to think how can we on the one side keep the colonial question going and with it, but on the other side related to the German situation or the German discourse at that time, the answer for that was to say we have to look for global issues which all the or a lot of societies in the world are encountering, and where the West plays a major role in the problem making, and take that, let's say, as a starting point to have a real discussion where Germans can relate to, but other people from other parts of the world can relate to too. And the first project in this context was, of course, in 2011 then, and it was triggered to some extent by the climate conference in Copenhagen in 2009, was on the question of how to deal with climate change. Because evidently climate change is a problem we are all concerned with, the way we approached this problem was what we saw. I mean, a lot of cultural institutions were doing projects on climate change at that time. And for us, what became very important is to put the audience into an actor point, perspective, to be an agent, not to be just an object of a process you cannot control at all. And in order to do that, the title of the project was, in German, it's called Überlebenskunst. And the title means it's ambivalent. On the one side, it says we are in a crisis of survival. And on the other side, it puts the question, what is a good life in our time? And the question, what is a good life in our time, provides agencies to the I define what is a good life in our time. So in this context, we made a call for future in Berlin for groups, artists, intellectuals, to propose projects which are articulating new modes of living in our time. So it was not at all a theoretical project. Was just what are new practices to confront the situation we are in. And the basic themes which were then addressed in this project, and we had about 800 reactions from all over Berlin, were food, mobility, energy, and housing. These were the four major questions people were concerned with. And as I said, there were about 800 proposals. And then out of this, we developed a one-week project. Just to give you an idea how this went, for example, there was an artist group which was working in the relationship between cities and the countryside. And they developed a project for to feed 10,000 people just with local food. So they developed a whole, over a year, a whole infrastructure how to get local food for 10,000 people. And this project was called Food Store and Storage, Food Storage, because when you want to get local food in Germany, you have to take care of the seasons. And you have to collect the food over the year in order to provide it at the time. So you develop directly a new relationship to food, which goes beyond just taking it locally, but having time, having the season in mind, and so on. So this was a major project in 2011. And in the context of this project, I encountered the notion of the Anthropocene, because we were researching what could be interesting conceptual approaches to the issues we are working on, and Christian Schwegel, colleague of Müller-Jung, he wrote had written a book on the Anthropocene at that time. And for me, when I read the book, what was fascinating was that natural scientists were arguing basically, and I directly make a jump, that the old categories on which Western knowledge is based, between culture on the one side and nature on the other side, are not functioning anymore, because humans are transforming the whole planet. And that means that what we look at as nature is already the outflow of consciousness. And on the other side, when you look at the technosphere discussion around it, we created a nature which is constantly transforming us too. So we become naturalized and the nature becomes culturalized in this process to some extent, using the old categories. So what I was fascinated with at that point, just strategically, was that here natural sciences put forward, or had findings, I would say, had findings, which were really questioning the Western traditions of knowledge productions in a deep way. And this directly I linked to the whole post-colonial discourse we had at that time. Because in the post-colonial discourse, still all over Germany at that time, what people, and I make it now a bit simple, but in general I think it was right, what they tried to prove is that non-Western people are good scientists, as we are. They are good artists, as we are. So in all this relationship, the point of reference was the West. So suddenly we came at the point where the Western knowledge production itself and Western institutions of knowledge productions were questioned. I found that a very interesting way from our perspective to translate the post-colonial discourse into another discourse where it plays still a very important role, as you pointed out. Do I have to explain a little bit the Anthropocene, or you all are familiar with the concept? I don't want to...
I feel like it would be useful for you to give a definition, for example, when you were talking about Überlebenskunst.
Okay.
You gave a definition, but it wasn't of the term the art of survival.
Yeah.
For example, but
yeah.
You interpreted it with so many words.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It might be helpful just to give a brief
definition. I mean, it's not a definition, but I start with the findings of basically earth scientists, and then later geologists joined the thesis, was to say that humans developed in the 20th century, essentially. It started, of course, the cognitive processes, which led to the process, start much earlier. But basically, in the 20th century, they were able to develop energies with their technologies, which are transforming the whole planet, and bringing the balance which the planet had for quite some time now in the Holocene out of balance. So the major point here is to say, not humans are intervening into the Earth system only, but the major point is to say they are intervening to such an extent that they disbalance the Earth system. So they disbalance the ground on which they live. And what is interesting, this is the major point. And this has, philosophically quite a number of implications. So the question is what are the major drivers that humans became able to disbalance the whole planet? And from my perspective, these are three drivers. The number one driver is humans were able to transform what the planet was developing over millions of years into energy they use on a daily basis. So they were transforming, so to say, the deep time of the planet into the actual time we are living in. And when you really understand this, you understand what kind of energies suddenly were there, and that these are, it's really a qualitative transformation which is going on. Then the second point is, of course, the technologies. They develop technologies which enable these transformation of transforming Earth time into human time. So, and the third is, of course, capitalism. What capitalism is doing basically is also time related. Capitalism is transferring, so to say, the future by credits into the present. So we are consuming time. We are consuming the Earth time, and we are consuming the future time in order to provide these energies, which are transformative, and not only transformative. I mean, they are really disbalancing the Earth system we are living in. So, and out of this, there are, first of all, this. These time frames is also challenging certain kind of Western disciplines. For example, history, classical historians, they are not able to, because they have no knowledge about natural sciences, they have no knowledge about the Earth system, so they don't have the instruments really to tell the situation we are in, because now very different parameters are interacting in this new system. So having said this, what happens in the natural sciences is of course a very abstract way of dealing with this process, because geologists, which and there is an Anthropocene working group which now tries to formalize this project, what they are doing is they are concentrating just on the material transformations which were going on. And of course, abstracting completely from the political, cultural, social implications. They are not, they don't have the means to do that. So what I found interesting for a cultural institution like the HKW, being a Western institution, is that we should unfold, so to say, what the scientists are abstracting from. That means inbuilt in these material processes, if you take, for example, sediments of the last 200 years, you can see how their political processes, economical processes, social processes are inbuilt. And then, of course, you see in the next step that the drivers of this process from an abstract point of view, it's human mankind. But in a historical, contextualized way, they are certain actors doing this. I mean, it's not a human mankind as a whole. So there are some people who are driving these processes, and the other, and quite a number of the others are affected by the processes. And then the next point is this, that the since we have, you use the term quite often, technoscience, we have a combination between technology, science, and capitalism, where you have a group of people who are more and more deciding about these processes, but completely out of the public sphere. And to some extent, the one argument of them is the transformations are so fast that we cannot consult the public. I mean, if you look at technological generations now, some of them take 2-3 years. We just spoke last night about social media, platforms such as Facebook, which or Google or the others, they started more or less beginning of the 2000s, and they are now the major economical drivers. So, I mean, they are mining. It's not anymore gold which is mined, but social individual data of people are the new materials for this process. From our perspective, what became very important is to say cultural institutions which are serving the society, they should have the obligations to develop projects, programs, which are opening these indoor processes for a larger public and for public discussions. And doing that on the one side is, of course, interesting in the context of Germany. There we are building up quite a number of relationships to other. But since this is a global and planetary challenge, it's of course very important to do that over the globe. And having said that, it becomes of course clear that in this process, what I spoke of, and I hope I made it clear enough, is we developed this conceptual approach out of a quite clear historical frame where there are other projects in the projects which are trying to articulate this frame. For example, the role of California in the in the world, new world order. And what became clear is that this is a planetary problem and a global issue, but the articulations on the ground are very specific. Highly contextualized, and I think the challenge is now to get into processes where the different worldviews get the kind of space to exchange with each other related to this process. And I see this whole Mississippi project as one such project. And what is interesting is that it's not just about Berlin coming to the Mississippi or Europe coming to the Mississippi, but if you just look at the diversity of the Mississippi, as I try to make clear also in the process, you have very different worldviews which are, and what you can see is that each or the members or the conscious people with these worldviews, they are addressing similar issues but from different perspectives. So, and the I think the one aim of this project should be to have a forum where this kind of perspectives are exchanged, and of course where one looks may develop forms of solidarity and forms of support for each other. Not trying to impose one's worldview on the other, but really try to connect worldviews to each other. In the context of the Anthropocene, and this is a very important aspect I want to stress at the end, is this whole, for me, the Anthropocene is also an interesting concept because it's not defined yet. And I understand our work as practicing a practice which by the work we do, we are start to define what the concept is. And for example, what is quite often mentioned in the Anthropocene discussion is the question of scaling. On the one side, you live in a very concrete local situation, but in this local situation, you have instruments at hand which are transforming other parts of the world. So one has constantly switch scales from the local, regional, national, international to the planetary. This, to some extent, is true, but not completely. And there, I think, for example, a cultural perspective would say, if you do it like this, if you do it just by scaling, you assume that the world is homogeneous, and you just scale. But I think the cultural challenge. to develop these kind of interrelations where you are not scaling, but you are dealing on the same level with other parts of the world and getting their perspectives in. I think there's an interesting, that would be, for example, a very interesting point of discussion, especially with natural scientists or people from technology, because they are constantly thinking of scaling. And if you look, and this will be my last words, if you look at the problems of the 20th century, you can say, and these were really anthropocentric answers to the problems, is that quite a number of the essential problems of the world one tried to tried to use by scaling, and doing so, one created quite a number of real problems. The first is, if you look at the question of poverty and food, when you look at the Green Revolution, they introduced chemical fertilizers all over the world. This is a typical scaling answer.
Which revolution?
The Green Revolution.
The Green Revolution in the 50s. I heard Korean Revolution. I'm interpreting my in Portuguese.
The Green Revolution, what by chance, and probably most of them of you know that, to some extent was an outcome of the military complex in the United States when they had the way they dealt with phosphorus. And so you had the industries there, and then you translated it as a transported it worldwide. So the Green, if you look at the Green Revolution, if you look at the nuclear power, which was meant to solve all our power problems, and also our democracy problems seem to be solved by the internet at the beginning of the 90s, and the other. So these are all three examples where the logics of scaling evidently does not work. And we have to look for new cultural ways of dealing with global issues we are all concerned with and local articulation. Sorry.
No, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, this question of naming our history and the complex sets of histories that we all bring to this personally, institutionally, culturally, and how those all come into dialogue with each other, I think is one of the certainly what we hope this whole project helps to facilitate that, and I think is already happening. So thank you for helping us all to understand the background that brings the House of World Culture, the HKV, and the Max Planck Institute, and the University of Minnesota, and all of these institutions and people together. Do people need just a moment to stretch their legs or run to the restroom or anything before we, or any other responses or questions? Yeah.
I've got an idea.
Mm-hmm.
The fisheries and wildlife students are out on Elk Lake in groups, and it looks windy and chilly, and so I'm guessing we'll get some more boats coming through for coffee. So one thing we could do is I could introduce myself, and then we could walk over to another building that'll be quieter.
Hmm.
That's close.
That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be a leg stretcher and
air observance.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Shade, but that sounds good.
Yeah,
that
sounds good.
No coffee over there, so if we wanted to get coffee or anything.
Yeah. Okay. But
yeah.
You wanna be
sure.
Introduce yourself, please.
Yep. I was thinking I could introduce myself here. I could tell you a little bit about the station as we walk, and then once we get over to this other building. We all have numbers on the buildings here, so it's number 44.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I was going to do before I forget, I'm just in the middle of reading Braiding Sweetgrass.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Read
that. My wife has read it twice. She gave me the book,
mm-hmm.
and I'm in there. But there's a quote in there that struck a chord with me that's kind of the motivation for the station a bit, because we're focus on basic science here. I came from another college that was the land grant side, the agricultural mission, and so there's a lot of applied science over here. But the field station here in Cedar Creek, which is just north of the cities, is more focused on kind of basic science, so it's very observational. So there's a quote in there that I like from Robin Wall Kimmerer. It says, "From the very beginning of the world, the other species were a lifeboat for the people, now we must be theirs. But the stories that might guide us, if they're told at all, grow dim in memory. Mm-hmm. And I like that. So I feel like for us as a station, a lot of the history was this basic observational science. It has a lot of room for storytelling. It has a lot of room for other perspectives. And so I'll use that as my introduction. I've been here for a year and a half now, in my second year as the director here, but I've been at the university since 2006. And I was in an applied engineering department. I was always kind of out of place there because I study fungi. So my name, I should say my name, too, even though it's on a name tag here, just in case the students need me. But it's Jonathan Schilling. So I started at the U in 2006. I'm a mycologist. I study fungi. And I was in an engineering department that had a history of forest products type research. So I studied the right group of organisms and have been in that or was in that position until 2017. So before then, my research has had a more what we would call biogeochemistry, nutrient cycling, and a bigger scale understanding of how organisms drive things like the carbon cycle, which we should be interested in. In being in the engineering department and going through the tenure process and all of that stuff, I became very versed at just the simple mechanisms that fungi particularly use to degrade plant materials and maintain some biogeochemistry, large-scale research by doing things that didn't help me for tenure, but I did just fine on the other side, which was learning the basic mechanisms of how these fungi work, because there are various parties, including the Department of Energy, that was interested in how organisms break down plant biomass. So I've gone through that process of maintaining a very active lab of researchers and have gone through the process of full professor now, and I'm at a point where I can begin to take some risks, I guess, with my job. Or I could coast. Those are my two options. right now, I have enough energy to try to take some risks. But this job is not like a department head job. It's the director of the field station. It has no term limit. And so I'm not in and out in 5 years. This could be for the next 20 or 25 years of my career. So my approach here is, first of all, to hang my hat on the tradition of the station, which has always been conservation and not preservation. It's always been about conservation with some assumption that there needs to be management involved. But also sharing that so that others are on board with conservation. And, for me to do that at this time, I think, involves opening the lines of communication with people that are here, whereas these field station, brick and mortar field stations have for a long time been isolated as outposts for the university so that people could get out of the city to go study in the place where things have not been screwed up as much. And instead, it's an opportunity to have more interface with the local community. So I'm interested in doing that, which is, I think, a new role for the field stations, but also, again, continuing the research in the name of conservation that comes from doing some basic science. So with that, I can, if anyone has any questions about that part of things, the university job or anything like that, I'm really here to represent myself. I can show you the station. We can talk about that. I've missed all of the Anthropocene meetings in the city because this past year has been crazy. But yeah, I'm interested in what you're doing. I'm glad that you're here. And I'm getting more and more used to these types of conversations, I guess, to this day. If anybody has any questions. Otherwise, I was thinking we could walk, look at the lake, and I can tell you what's out there, tell you a little bit about the history of the state park here. You'll get some of that from Connie at 1. She's great. She's local. I'm from the city. I live in St. Paul 9 months out of the year, and I'm up here for the summer. So she'll be your local flavor. She'll know more about the history. But I can talk to you a bit about the history of the station here and how it links in with the state park, and it's cool. So.
Cool.
Does that sound all right?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. We're going that way.